Good morning and welcome to Wanda Six, a Black arts and culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. wandaspix.asmnetwork.org. Tune in Wednesdays 6 to 7 a.m. and Fridays 8 to 10 a.m. Pacific Time. This is a Black arts and culture site. We will be exploring the African diaspora via the writing, performance, both musical and theatrical, film and stage, as well as the visual arts of Africans in the diaspora and those influenced by these aesthetic forms of expression. I'm interested in the political and social ramifications of art on society, specifically movements supported by these artists and their forebears. It is my claim that the artists are the true revolutionaries, their work honest and filled with raw, unedited passion. They are true heroes. Ashe. So remember, visit us on Wednesdays 6 to 7 a.m. and Fridays 8 to 10 a.m. Pacific Time on wandaspix.asmnnetwork.org.
Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks. The first part of our program, we were joined by Robert Hillary King, author of the new book, From the Bottom of the Heap, the autobiography of a Black Panther, Robert Hillary King, the only exonerated member of the Angola Three, and Parnell Herb, deputy. What's your title for Millions More, Panther Herb?
Yes, I'm the Minister of Justice with the Millions More Movement in
right.
Houston, Texas.
Excellent, excellent. So we're going to be talking about Albert Woodfox, who is having a hearing a little later on today in New Orleans, and what that means for the case. He's supposed to actually, hopefully, be walking free very soon. So why don't you all talk about Angola 3, the case, the men, and what this hearing, this final hearing means for Albert Woodfox.
Bert, be my guest.
King, are you going to take that?
You should take that.
Okay, my guest, Bert. Rhonda would want to, she wanted to talk about, a little bit about Angola 3, and she brought, me and Albert, that you were at the hearing, I wasn't at the, you was at the press conference last week, and
yes, sir.
Some things occurred there, so you could bring us up to date as much as I could, because I was not present at the time.
Yes, sir. Okay, well, first of all, Angola 3 is, its history is well known, and this past Friday, we had a press conference dealing with the situation with Albert Woodfox. After his bail hearing was extended 10 days and another 10 days, the state attorney general, Caldwell, threw some stuff in the game and said that if Albert were to be freed on bail, that he would bring up some new fabricated charges that he that his office came up with. So we called a press conference in New Orleans Friday, and we addressed that. We had people to discuss the history of Angola 3. We spoke of our relationships with Brother Albert and Brother Herman. We also had Brother to step forward and call Buddy Caldwell, State Attorney General in New Orleans, a liar. We pointed out that the state itself is guilty because they lied when they created the original charges of murder to put on Brother Albert and Brother Herman and other brothers, actually. But it shows the history of the lies and deceit that they've been using on the public in general and trying to keep these Black Panthers down, which is, again, it was a part of a government conspiracy years ago to destroy the Black Panther Party, and that conspiracy has not changed. So we were honored to be able to address that and say it to the public and call Buddy Caldwell a liar and say how devious and demonic he is and the things that they're doing to try to keep Brother Albert under wraps.
King, I wanted to ask you if you could talk about the importance of the Angola 3 case in light of, our other political prisons and prisons of war, something that you mentioned, well, Geronimo mentioned it, and then you elaborated on when you were on the air this past Friday, you and Pastor Herb, Geronimo Chijaga.
We cannot, you know, separate the cases of Herman and Albert, or myself, or for that matter, the collective cases on that angle, the three apart from all of other sphere cases that exist in America, because we know, as Herb alluded to just now in giving the press conference, how he pointed out the state initially manufactured evidence against Herman and Albert, mainly because they were members of the Black Panther Party. So when you see the, Jijaga pointed out last week, you see the Sunday out of Coley's, you know, the Marion Bucks, go on and on and on into infinity, naming political. And you could see the conspiracy why, and it was something that was orchestrated by the FBI in the 60s to crush the movement. If you were a member of any movement, it doesn't matter passively or impassively, if you were looked at or you were targeted. You were targeted by COINTELPRO or counterintelligence program. And if you were, like I say, in prison, it did not make any difference. The idea was to keep you in prison. And even though Herman and Albert were not in prison and these charges was orchestrated against them while in prison, it wasn't any accident. And the fact that I was also, after it has been known that I was a member of the Black Panther Party, never did I try to hide it, you know. But when the authorities realized I was a member of the Black Panther Party, they decided to extend the conspiracy, widen the conspiracy. They could not include me in the on the same charges in which Herman and Albert were charged with, but they did manage to get someone to say that I had participated in the death of another inmate. And they couldn't do this initially because I was not in prison. If I would have been in prison, I would also have been charged and not only investigated for 31 years or for 29 years, but I would have been charged with that crime as well. So when you look at the case in connection with all of the other cases, political prisoners, and what was going on way back in the 60s and 70s when they started targeting the Black Panther Party. This is just a continuation. This is just the results of what took place way back in that time when they were trying to suppress different movements. So the connections are there.
So, Herb, talk about the press conference. I noticed in some of the pictures, which our listeners can view by going to wandaspicks.com and clicking on the blog. There are some photographs, and everyone had on a black shirt with the white letters, "I am Albert Woodfox." So, except you had a suit on, but some other people had on suits. Tell me what the strategy was, and also you all were in the gallery of the art exhibit, the house that Herman built, which is was done by Jackie Sumall. So I was going in New Orleans. So tell me about, you know, why everyone had that shirt on.
Okay, that was Jackie Sumall's design. I am Herman Wallace. I am Albert Woodfox. And the point was we could all be Herman or Albert. You know, something I say is, there go I. And that's all it is. It could have happened to any of us, and any of us could be in that same situation. And when I say any of us, I mean any citizen of America. Your race, your sex, none of that makes a difference. If they want to do something to you, they can do it to you. And, you know, so often you hear people say, well, I don't want to get involved, or that doesn't concern me. But if it happens to you, if it happens to your loved one, then you are concerned. And actually, it's partially your fault for not doing something about it when you saw it being done to someone else. So those T-shirts, I think, were great because the message was it could be any of us. And that was the whole point. That's Sister Jackie Sumall, beautiful artist, the sister that this house that Herman built. And yeah, the Cultural Arts Center of New Orleans allowed us to do our press conference in their building in front of Jackie's display.
Mm-hmm. Right. King, you mentioned in your book a little bit of how you met Albert Wood Fox and Herman Wallace, if you could talk about sort of, you know, since you know Albert personally, could you talk about, you know, that first meeting with him and Herman and how initially, well, you had already been doing the work before you all connected, because you said that you told me that you had actually been seen as a protector of the young men coming into Angola prison who were often targeted by corrupt persons to be, you know, induced and enslaved as sexual toys for the men. So anyway, if you could talk about, you know, Albert Wood Fox, give us, you know, tell us, you know, what kind of person is he, et cetera, et cetera. How did you all meet?
Oh, well, I mean, briefly, I'll try to sum it up. I met Albert some years ago. That was before the Black Panther Party came into existence. I had met Albert sometime in 1965 during the first Josin. So, you know, it's...
Do you have that Bluetooth thing on?
No, I don't.
Okay. All right, cool. Because I heard like a little feedback. All right, go ahead. Sorry.
No, I don't. I have them on speaker, though, if this might be the problem. If being on speaker is a problem, I can speaker.
Okay. Would you mind holding it?
I'm holding it anyway, even though I have it on speaker. But so it wouldn't make a difference, I said. And taking it off speaker, though, I might cut you off, so I may have to call. I don't know. May have to call back. Let me see.
All right. Okay.
Wanda, I think can you hear me now? What about now? Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear.
Yes.
You. I just heard some ambient noise. That's all.
Oh well, yeah. I was probably sitting down in a chair. You probably heard that. This is a very sensitive phone. But in any event, I had met Albert in 1965. That was prior to the Black Panther Party being this, you know, being coming out as an organization. And so I had knew him, but it wasn't, we did not have a, what we call a personal relationship. It wasn't until some years later. And I had met Herman a couple of years after I met Albert Wood Fox. And it wasn't until some years later that we just so happened to be in the past prison and we were caught up in the times. Herman and Albert have always questioned the system, has always been, you know, rebels and so forth and so on. And so I guess it wasn't any coincidence that we happened to meet up and we were attracted by, you know, some of the same things that were going on during the 60s, especially with regards to how people were struggling against, you know, repression. I think Albert and Herman had been arrested as young men and they were back in prison, and each of them, you know, decided, you know, that was the question, the veracity. You know, and in questioning the veracity, they discovered the principles of the Black Panther Party, and they saw how it coincided with some of the same thoughts and feeling in which they had felt. And so they, as I did at the time, embraced this ideology. And so we didn't just meet and discuss anything. We adopted a philosophy of struggle. We adopted the struggle as being our inheritance, and we just happened to end up in Angola, in Louisiana State Prison, around the same time again, you know. And usually waters have a way of coming together, and so, you know, we were together. The people saw us as, I imagine, being a threat, and this is why they were able to put me into prison under investigation, even though I was not there, because they had already lumped me up with being the same type of water in which Albert and Herman was. As I say, waters have a tendency to come together, and the administration understood this. So this is how we came together, and we all just so happened to be attracted and influenced, you know, by the Black Panther Party, which coincided with things that we already felt internally but could not explain. And so the Black Panther Party were able to articulate this for us, and we joined the struggle, you know, not so much as an organization or structure organization. We joined the struggle. And so we had something in common. We recognized that we had to fight if we wanted to survive.
Right. Yeah. So as we draw toward the end of this discussion, which we will continue on Friday after the hearing, and hopefully we'll have great news for our audience. Could either one of you all talk about the importance of the hearing today and what it means, what's going to happen in court today?
Well, who can chip in if you wish to, but I think the hearing today is to determine whether or not Albert could be released on bond. The judge is hearing opposition from the Attorney General office with regards to Albert being released, and they also will hear some favorable, evidence coming from our side. Of course, it should be that way anyway. Our lawyers should be presenting this type, reason as to why Albert should and could be released in communities that would accept him. And the judge, he's looking at the evidence today, and he's going to weigh this evidence, and we are hoping that sometime after today, he will make a determination, and I think it will be expedited because I think he's going to make his decision pretty soon, unless there has been a change of heart, and I don't think so. And I think this decision will be made pretty soon, and we can look forward to Albert being released, probably on bond without restrictions. Hopefully.
Right, yeah, because when you were released 7 years ago, you were released without restrictions because of all of the charges were dropped, right?
Of course, and of course that was, the other sector that came in, the state, the charge of murder was dropped against me, and they initially got a conspiracy, so-called, quote, conspiracy charge, in which... they adjudicated this case, because the story goes, they didn't want to really be brought up for any litigation, so they had to kind of protect themselves, and they accepted they allowed me to plead guilty to a conspiracy to commit murder, and equated my time to time served, and I was released. But as we know the story, that's what they wanted to do to make sure that, G. Jagger had recently been released and they had to make a settlement, both state and federal, and they wanted to eliminate, any means of my being compensated by the state.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Hopefully, in this case with Herman and Albert, that won't happen. The measure, because it's not a matter of Herman and Albert, no conspiracy. These are Herman and Albert are totally, absolutely innocent, and the federal court has said as much. Albert, if you look at the ruling in the case, he has been exonerated. It is the state who refuses now. In the form of Buddy Caldwell, as Herbert pointed out, in Sinkfield, who prosecuted the case, it is their wish and desire not to acknowledge that the state committed error. Again, like I alluded to last week, it seems as if they're trying to cover up a bigger crime. And Herman and Albert and the other two members of Angola who made up the Angola 4 team have become scapegoat, and they want to keep it like that. But we want to expose that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to close with giving people the website so they can find out more about Angola 3, Angola, the numeral 3.org, and Three Black Panthers is the other website. And then It's About Time .com is another great website. Panther Herb, do you want to give the phone number that people can call?
I still don't have the phone number, but
Yeah, it's on the website. You could people can check the website for the radio show, and it's there from last week, and also at wandaspicks.com. I want to end with this piece from your book, King, From the Bottom of the Heap. It's toward the end. It's in your postscript, and you say that, again, I'll say that legality and morality are opposites in this country, and contrary to what people may believe, the deeper discussion at this time should not be about the immorality inherent in the American legal system, but rather about the people relinquishing their power. We, the people, are our own greatest resource. We, not elected officials, are empowered en masse to redirect our own course. And in redirecting our course, one of our main focuses has to be the prison system and how it is linked to slavery of old. Whether my release from prison has positively impacted the cases of Albert and Herman remains to be seen. I will continue to champion their cause as well as that of other prisoners. The National Coalition to Free the Angola Three and other political prisoners and political victims with branches in New Orleans, Texas, New York, Chicago, and California with supporters in England, Amsterdam, Holland, Paris, Portugal, Belgium, Germany, and Africa will not give up the fight. We all know that. The struggle continues. So with that, I'd like to thank you all for being on my show this morning. And I need to click over because we're going to be talking about what's going on in Congo right now, which is another travesty, international warfare that is being called a civil war to sort of take attention away from what's really going on. And people can tune in on Friday to hear more about what's going on with Angola 3, Albert's case in particular, at 8 a.m. Pacific time.
Okay.
All right. Thank you so much, both
thank
of you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
All right. All right. Take care.
Okay.
Peace and blessings.
Okay. To you too. Bye.
Bye. Good morning, and welcome to Wanda's Picks. is this, just a second, is this Kambale?
Yes, ma'am. How are you
super.
This morning?
I'm good. We've been joined by Kambale Musavuli, who is a Congolese activist and member of Friends of the Congo and the Global Student Coordinator for the Break the Silence campaign launched by Friends of Congo. Mr. Musavuli is pursuing a civil engineering degree at North Carolina A&T State University. He has worked to develop programs to create positive interactions within the African-American and African community as the president of the Association of African Students. He works with activists in Greensboro to bring about reasonable minimum wage and cultural understanding in his community. In his spare time, he enjoys building websites and learning and testing open source programs. He hopes to change his home country, the Congo, and bring fundamental change to end the exploitation of the Congolese people and its land. Welcome, and thank you so much for joining us on Wanda's Picks at such short notice. So tell us what's going on in Congo. I know it's an international warfare that is being seen by the external, you know, popular media as civil war, and people are just getting killed. Like, oh my God, it's just horrible. And it's been going on for a long, long time, and it just sort of fades in and out of the media, of the news, and it's one of the greatest, I guess it's one of the largest losses of humanity, continuous. I don't know how many years it's been going on, but it's been, like, I don't know, almost since Patrice Lumumba was killed or murdered by Western powers, including our own. Just the conflict and the killing has just been ongoing. So tell us about what's happening there presently and sort of couch that in the context of historically what's going on in Congo.
Yes. My apologies. I have a bit of a cold. But the plight of the Congo has been going on for hundreds of years. The latest spasm has been going on for 12 years, actually. It started in 1996, where we see nearly 6 million people dying since that time. And the root cause of the conflict in the Congo is the scramble for its mineral resources. And as you put that in the context, Congo literally has every mineral known to man right in its land. And the Congo is one-fourth the size of the United States and is the size of Europe. So that just shows you the vast land and the possibility of providing resources to the Western world. The plight in 1996, we've had the two invasion of Rwanda into the Congo. I'm pretty sure you are familiar with the movie of the Rwanda with the genocide that happened in 1994.
Mm-hmm, yes.
What actually happened was a regime change in Rwanda, which is now exploiting the resources of the Congo and selling it to world corporations in the pretext that they are chasing the people who committed the genocide. Just to give you a picture, many of the refugees that came to the Congo at the time were children and women. Of course, we had a few rebels also that crossed over the Congo. But they chose 1996 to 98 to continuously attack the Congo. While they were attacking the Congo, they were extracting minerals and selling it to world corporations. And one of the key minerals that's being actually exported from the Congo is called coltan. And coltan is found in your cell phones, laptop, DVD players, VCR, even pacemakers, even microwaves use coltan.
Wow.
The pacemaker, yes. So
yeah.
It's essential to electronic devices. Virtually every phone uses coltan. And you know how the electronic industry has boomed in the late 2000-2001, and how you can compare that to the deaths and the atrocities that happened in the Congo all through this time, where we have PDAs now, we have Blackberries, all of it. With the demand being so high, the supply chain has to provide those resources, and they could care less that one life is lost because of these resources. Even though I'm mentioning so many horrors and so many things that's happening, there is hope to change it. I believe that with the latest fight that has occurred in the past 3 weeks, where now we have 200,000 people being displaced, added to the already 1.5 million people already displaced. And I'm letting you know those people being displaced are put in a situation where eventually they will die because they are not provided support. They do not have food. They do not have clean sanitation. So they're left literally to die, displaced from areas where minerals are and the minerals are living. But as I see that, and I understand that a military solution will only create more death in my country, I believe that a political solution to end the exploitation of the Congo needs to be presented to the world community. And we should use people that have Kagame's ear, and Kagame is the president of Rwanda. We can use people like Bill Clinton. He does business in Rwanda. We can use people like Bill Gates. They have business industry there. We have Costco there. We have Starbucks there. And all these businesses and people doing business in Rwanda, understanding that there are 6 million people that have died in the Congo, and half of them are children, 5 years old and younger, and still have not broken the silence. Is almost a scar to the conscience. So we're calling that to the world community. If it was your child being killed just because they stepped outside to play soccer, how would you feel? If your mother was raped in front of you and your father killed in front of you, and now they're taking you to a rebel army, what will you do to stop this atrocity that's been going on for 12 years? And I believe that it can be stopped. And the central root cause of what's happening is the scramble for Congo's mineral resources, not ethnic conflict or anything of that nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what would you like our listeners to do? I mean, we can definitely go visit the website friendsofcongo.org and read some of the publications that stories that have come out on CongoWeek.org, and people can call the number 888-584-6510. But tell us, you know, besides that, you know, who should we be targeting? Any particular legislators in particular? Should we be boycotting anything? It'd be great if we could boycott cell phones, not pacemakers necessarily, but definitely the cell phone. What would you like us to do to sort of? You know, I mean, this, you know, you said it's been going on for a long time. People have been getting killed, and you don't hear about it that much in the Western media.
Exactly. Yeah, and I understand also why it's not, people do not really know. If you could just imagine how much money are being made daily in the Congo, you would be amazed. But what specifically people can do, the number one thing that I want people to do is to educate themselves about the Congo and kind of make the connection. Just to put things in perspective, Congo has a large history connected to the United States. I will talk about William Shepherd, the first African-American Presbyterian missionary to go to the Congo. He was there in the late 1890. working with the Congolese people. You have George Washington Williams as well, and people in the 60s that continuously work with the Congolese. So educate themselves about the history of the Congo, the tragedies of what's happening, and the potential of it. Not necessarily become a critical reader of what's happening so you don't have a picture of hopeless Africans, but more so of corporate interest disabling their ability to govern themselves. The second thing that I will ask people to do, you already mentioned the cell phone boycott. That's something that we've been doing. We've had two cell phone boycotts this year. The first one was March 26th, and the second one was October the 22nd, where we asked people to turn off their cell phone for 6 hours or more. But we were also asking them to change their voicemail, explaining why their phone is off. So, because we know people will still call your phone. So when they call your phone, they will understand the plight of the Congo. You can say, no, my name is Juan. Hey, sorry, you have reached me. I'm not able to answer my phone, and my phone is off in solidarity with the 6 million deaths in the Congo due to content that's used on my cell phone. Call me back at 6, and I will let you know what's happening in the Congo. Something of that nature. Mm-hmm. The third one is to provide support to the Congolese people. There are numerous NGOs working on the ground, as included, working with the people who are displaced, providing support to the women being raped. That's something I did not really go into detail so you could understand what's happening. We have 200,000 reported rapes in the Congo, and they state that Congo is the worst place for any woman to be living because of the symptoms of war has caused many of the women to be raped. And we now have a program where we help the rape victims, because what happens to them is that as they are raped, sometimes they are rejected in the community and they can't help or sustain themselves. So we try to help them have a small business so they can continue to feed their family. Fourth, become a friend of the Congo. Visit the website, click on Becoming a Friend of the Congo, and you will see what you can do. And ultimately, as we continue to fight, we want you to join our network and advocate for the Congo by sending letters to your congressman, your representatives, and especially the United States president. I believe deep in my heart Barack Obama is very well aware of what's happening in the Congo. In 2005, he introduced a legislation stating if Africa has to achieve its promises, resolving the conflict in the Congo will be critical. So I know that he has Congo in his heart and he will address this issue, but it will take the citizens of the United States to press that issue to the new president to address the conflict in the Congo.
Right, yeah. Well, we have run out of time right at the moment, but we definitely want to continue this conversation. Thank you so much again for coming on the show to talk about what's going on in Congo. And I was wondering, do you have any other days planned? I'd love to participate in one of the boycotts. Do you have any dates coming up that we could sort of, put in our...
Yes. The next
yeah,
one,
sorry
of course,
for all
is
the noise.
Be...
I've clicked on some other folks in our studio, and there's a lot of ambient sound. I don't know what it is exactly. But hopefully people can hear through that. So tell me again, do you have any dates coming up?
Yes,
we're
very engaged with different events. Next one actually coming up is November 15th. It's a historical date in the history of the Congo. So we will ask people to use that as a forum to address the issue of the Congo by different means. You can do a cell phone boycott. You can show a film on the Congo. You can do a party where you're inviting people to speak about the Congo and so many different things you could do to address the issue. On March 8th next year, we have a vigil, an international vigil for the women in the Congo. So we're using it as a teaching and vigil to pray for peace in the Congo and also provide support to all the women in the Congo. And in July of 2009, we will have a concert in Louisiana at Congo Square.
Oh.
Connect Congo Square with Congo Kinshasa, since we have a historical bond with Congo Square in Louisiana, knowing that almost all the slaves that came in the United States in the 1600s came from the Congo-Angola region, and most of them were in the Louisiana-Georgia area.
Right.
And try to reconnect them. And, of course, on the website, we will continuously put new events and new action items that we are pushing. And one thing I forgot to mention, people should look at the Dan Ryder report called All Minds. It talks about a U.S. corporation, Freeport-McMoRan, that's extracting copper in the Congo, and it explains in great detail how world corporations are literally killing Congolese people.
Yeah, and tell me again the name of, you said, the report, and how can people access that?
It's actually on our website, in the download area, on our CongoWeek.org website.
Okay, yes.
And the report is called All Mine, and it was done by the Dan Ryder Report from CBS.
Okay, excellent, excellent. Well, so the 15th, which is Saturday, is a time to bring attention to what's happening in the Congo, and you can find out more about actions that you can take personally, you know, from showing a film to having a cell phone boycott and leaving an outgoing message to let your friends know why you are not using your cell phone on the 15th, which is Saturday, by going to the website friendsofcongo.org, and also you can look at all of the supportive materials at congoweek.org. And again, you can call 888-584-6510. Well, thank you so much, Kambale Musavuli, for sharing with us what's going on in Congo, and we look forward to talking to you again about what's happening on the ground and how we can be of service to help end that horrible international war over the resources of the place, of this country.
Thank you for having me on your show, Wanda. I definitely appreciate your time.
All right, you take care. Have a good day.
You do the same.
Okay, peace and blessings. Well, I've been joined by a full studio of a lot of folks, and I don't know who I'm talking to. See, I know who was going to be calling, and Ivan was calling in, and Anuj and Mehreen Jabbar, but then I've got four people. So I'm not certain. So why don't y'all tell me who's on the line and tell us a little bit about yourself, because I can't find any of your bios except for the filmmaker. So, yeah. So tell me who's with me.
Hi, Wanda. This is Anuj.
Oh, hey. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. So you're one of the directors.
I'm the associate festival director.
Yeah.
For Third Eye.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And who else is in the studio?
Yeah.
Mehreen Jabbar from New York.
Right. Yeah. We're gonna talk about your wonderful film.
Hi. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ramshad Pakistani. Which
yeah.
is one of the feature films in
yeah.
this year's Third Eye Film
mm-hmm.
Festival. Okay, who else?
And Mehreen will be here in person for the film, too.
Oh, super, super, super.
Yeah, we're very excited about the film. This is Yvonne Jagadar. I have worked with Anuj on the film festival.
Okay.
Well, Yvonne's the festival director, yeah.
Oh, festival director. Oh, wow, we got some mm-hmm. big shots in the studio. Okay. And then there's a fourth person. Who is that? Oh, they're gone. Okay. I don't know who they were. Maybe it was a mistake. Okay, super. let's see, Anuj and Yvonne, why don't you talk about the festival? Which year is it for the festival? When does it start? Where is it going to be? Where is opening night? And what people can look forward to? And then we'll go into a talk with our director, who is on the line, and she can talk about her film, Ramchand Pakistani, which is a wonderful, wonderful film about the Dalit community, which also known as the Untouchables, and what happens, you know, when this child, you know, wanders across the, I guess, the border, and his father, you know, goes after him, and they get incarcerated. The child gets incarcerated with adults, and sort of the, you know, I guess, the steadfastness of the mother and the wife who's left behind, and keeping pursuing, you know, her family that's lost, even though people say, oh, they've been gone this long, they're not coming back. They've been gone a year, they're not coming back. They've been gone 2 years, they're not coming back. And she just pursues it, which shows, you know, how when someone is, you know, incarcerated, imprisoned here or elsewhere, if there are people on the outside that are advocating for them, even spiritually, you know, there's more chance that they will be released or that their cases won't get lost in the shuffle. So why don't you tell us about Third Eye?
Well,
I love the name Third Eye, you know, like, yeah. You know, that sense that, you know, we're not really aware of.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, I'll give you a very quick overview of the festival, and then hopefully Anuj will give us the details of all the films. But in terms of Third Eye, it deals with internal reflection, I guess, and but partially the name, because it's 3RDI and also spelled, I mean, our website is thirdeye.org, but we have an I there too, because we want to be secular and not totally like work on the exotic spiritualism of it all. But in terms of the festival, it's November 13th to the 16th, and the first 2 days are at the Brava Theater in San Francisco, and the last 2 days are at the Castor Theater in San Francisco. And we have a whole bunch of films, starting from local filmmakers and then going to more the sort of spectacle of cinema, shall we say, at the Castro. Anuj, do you want to go into more of the details of the films? Or?
Sure. We've got films actually from India, Pakistan. We've got 4 films from Pakistan this year, which we really are very happy about. We've got a film from Sri Lanka, which is great for the whole family. That's King Siri, and that plays at the Castro. It's a really wonderful film about 4 kids and about a kid making a journey from the village to the big city and making it big there. We've got 5 films by women filmmakers, which is a big focus for us this year. 2 at the Brava on Friday, including Mehreen's film. Then we have Nishtha Jain, who will be coming in for her documentary Lakshmi and Me on Saturday at the Castro. We featured her earlier film, City of Photos, a couple of years ago, and that was a really big success at the festival. So we're excited to have her here as well. Mm-hmm. And on Sunday, we're kicking off an environmental series, which will continue in the spring of 2009. And what we're showing now is Irene Salinas' Flow, which is about water issues, very pertinent right now. And we'll be following that up with a panel discussion with local experts on water issues. So much on the program, really. We've got 14 films over 4 days. The opening films on both days kind of hark back to the silent era at the Castro, I mean. Throw of Dice, which is a film from 1929, a co-production between India, Germany, and the UK, and it has a brand new score. It's been recently restored. And a great companion piece to that is the first film on Sunday morning, Bioscope, which kind of takes you back to 1920s in Kerala, when early cinema was first making its rounds. Do you want to talk about Makbul and
White
Women and Slumdog?
Yeah, I'll quickly go through that. Makbul is basically Macbeth, but in the context of Bombay and the mafia dens there. So it's co-presented by the Shakespeare Company of San Francisco. So it's a beautiful mix of Macbeth, as I said, in the Indian context. And we're really fortunate to have Slumdog Millionaire, which is a film by Danny Boyle, who did Trainspotting. And I think it's one of his best films, actually. And it's being released just before the festival, but we're showing it at the Castro Theater, so it's really worthwhile coming to see it there. And I think Glove White Women is probably the film which is a little on the provocative side, but it's by an Indian filmmaker who was born and brought up in South Africa, and it deals with the apartheid era in South Africa. And it's actually very interesting, and it deals with the whole symbolism of white women in that context. Did you want to go over any other particular films, Sanush?
Well, I just wanted to say we also showcase a lot of first-time filmmakers at our festival. So our opening night is first-time features by a lot of by two local filmmakers, Saqib Mosouf and Amin Kadir Ali. And also on Saturday night, we're going for the first time for a midnight, an almost midnight screening with a zombie flick from Pakistan called Hell's Ground. And we're hoping people will come out dressed in their zombie splendor. So that should be a fun event, too.
Can you give the website for the festival, please?
Yeah, the easiest website for us is thirdeye.org, and that's spelled thirdeye.org. So it's thirdeye.org. But it could take you to a different site, but that's the best way to get to us.
Okay, and then a phone number?
Phone number is, mm-hmm. is 415-835-4783. I'll repeat again. It's 415-835-4783.
Yeah. Yeah, what I really love about this festival is sort of the comprehensive nature of the art that, you know, the directors that you invite in, you know, is not it's the Asian diaspora as opposed to you know, one particular ethnic group or community. And I'm really happy that you're reaching out to women directors, because no matter what the culture, women are not necessarily the ones, you know, that are getting the, I guess, the resources to be able to make films and tell stories. And definitely women have a different way of looking at certain kinds of circumstances and phenomena. So with that, Maureen Jabbar, see, you worked in advertising for a couple of years before receiving a certificate from UCLA, University of California, Los Angeles, in 1993 in film, television, and video. And you returned to Pakistan to direct and produce made-for-TV movies and drama series under the banner of Tasveer Productions, almost all of which were critically acclaimed by the Pakistani press. You went on to direct short TV films and TV series for numerous TV channels in Pakistan, in addition to a number of short films which have been aired in festivals worldwide. Your award-winning films include Daughters of the Late Colonel and a four-part television show, Sanam Gazeta, Afshin. Yeah, I might be killing the name.
No, you're spot on. Not bad.
Okay, Afshin Kawab Dida E. Perkun and Lal Bak.
Big. Lal Big means cockroach, actually, in Urdu. Yeah.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, those are some of our, I guess they go back to the prehistoric time, one of the only prehistoric creatures that is around. your current film that's being premiered here is your first feature-length film, and I was really interested that you've been a member of the National Board of Film Censors in Karachi, and you're a founding member of War Against Rape. And I'm like, wow. I want you to talk to us about that, War Against Rape. You're also, member of the Kara Film Festival, Pakistan's only international film festival, in Karachi, and you've served as a juror at the Leeds International Film Festival in 2002. And you currently reside here in New York City. So, welcome. So tell us about, being a woman director and about this great feature film. And it's based on a true story. How did you come to find out about the story of this family?
This story actually came to me from my father, who's also produced the film. He has been working in the desert area where this film takes place for the last 20 years. He has an NGO there, which provides loans and healthcare and constructs schools, etc. So he came across this real-life father and son 3 years ago after they had been released from prison in India. And he was fascinated by the story. He wrote a synopsis and showed it to me on one of my trips back to Pakistan from New York. And there's something about the story that moved me, and it just gripped me, not only because it was a very intensely personal story about a separation of a family for no fault of its own, but there were so many underlying layers of other things, like the politics of the region, the relationship between Hindus and Muslims, the caste system, et cetera, et cetera. So in all, that actually just convinced me that this is the story I want to do as my first feature. And also I had my father backing me, so that was it made it easier.
Yeah. So I was wondering when I was watching it about the cast, were those professional actors or were there actors that were that lived in the region where the story takes place, and were they Dalit of the Dalit community?
No, the actors were a mixed range. The woman playing the mother is a very well noted, renowned actress from India called Nandita Das. And the other actors were all a mixture of TV and stage actors and some who had never acted before. We shot, a lot of the extras were from the villages itself, but the two boys, for example, had never acted before, the younger and the older Ramchand. Yeah, so it's a varied mixture of TV, stage, novices, and a big star.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how, like, your father told you the story, and I presume you met the family who
mm-hmm.
this actually happened to. So
mm-hmm.
how close is your film to the story, and what did the family think about the film, you know, once you've completed it and they saw, you know, sort of a...
Yeah. We met the family through a period of 1 year. In fact, the father and son remained during the entire process of the filming. So they were always on hand so we could consult them, especially during the prison sequences. If we were, you know, doing anything that was amiss, they could tell us. They saw the film when it was released in Pakistan. The film has been released in Pakistan and in India. And they were very happy. They saw it in a small town in Sindh. As far as reality goes, I think we've stuck to around 75% of what actually happened, and using the 30%, 25% as fiction, because, you know, you have to adapt a real life story and make it dramatic on the screen. And therefore, we do say in the beginning that it's adapted from real events instead of inspired or based on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was just thinking, you know, about, you know, having a story about the Dalit community and, you know, that's a community in the hierarchy that
mm-hmm.
is on the bottom. I mean, they do the nasty jobs, and
mm-hmm.
you know, in the prison, you know, the teacher initially didn't want the child to
yes.
touch her eating utensils and
yes.
anything that she had to touch, and she wouldn't touch him. And
yeah.
and also, the Dalit community is a community where there's African retention. You know, there are people of African descent. That are also Dalit, and that was what really attracted me to the film, to see a story about this community when I can't think of any movies about, are there any?
You know,
all are the experts.
Well, maybe in India, I'm not sure, because Pakistan, I mean, Hindus make up around 1.5% of the minorities in Pakistan, and the Dalits are at the lowest of the hierarchy, so they're even the minority of minorities, and they're the poorest of the poor. So they really, you know, generally people who cross borders belong to either the farmer class or the fishermen, because they cross over inadvertently by mistake. And as it is, they don't have a voice, and they don't have ways and means to approach governments to secure relief. And these are the people who get lost in the system and end up spending not just 4 or 5 years, but sometimes 25, 35 years. For no fault of their own. And especially because they come from the Dalit community, they have even less voice in the government.
Right, yeah.
There's actually a really great film, Wanda, called Samar, S-A-M-A-R, made by this Indian filmmaker, Shyam Benegal, kind of a veteran filmmaker,
which
is really about Dalit caste in India. It's really great.
Oh, cool.
If you can lay your hands on it.
Have you all shown this film in your festival?
No, it's not playing in our festival. It came out about eight years ago, I think. So
no, I said, have you played it in your festival? Is that no?
No, we haven't
played
it.
Okay, I'll have to look at it. S-A-M-A-R, Samar?
That's right.
Okay, yeah. When I was, I'm really interested in the prison the international prison industrial complex and how people are treated, you know, here in this country, because we have the largest, you know, we've incarcerated more people than countries, entire countries,
yeah.
in the United States. But I was looking, I saw a film a while back, and it looked at the Buddhist practice of Vipassana, and it was used in the Indian prison by, and I was really, the warden is a woman, or she was a woman, I don't know if she's still over the prison, and I was just thinking about, you know, when they were talking about, well, you're in prison here in India, and if you were in, Pakistan, I'm trying to think, were they in prison in Pakistan or India?
Mm-hmm. No,
Pakistan,
they were in prison in India.
Right, so I thought, okay. Yeah, and they said, you know, I mean, they were trying to get the kid, you know, he said, well, he's going to be here with him. He has to learn how to read and write. So he had schooling, and then the woman said, put him in, you know, children's clothes. And so I was wondering the differences, I mean, not that there's a good, you know, prison system, but just seeing that film on Vipassana, I don't know if you all are aware of it, but, you know, they use this Buddhist practice to humanize the guards, you know, the prison officials, you know, and to see the people that they were incarcerating as human beings. And I don't know, I mean, the way you portray the keepers, so to speak, you know,
we did. You know, the thing, what happened was, because it was based on a true story, we interviewed this father and son so extensively. We also visited one of the jails in Bhuj in India, next to where they were kept, not the actual jail. There are only two jails there, but we visit the other one. And they were told that they were not mistreated. But the reality is that a majority of jails, both in India and Pakistan, do mistreat their captives. And a lot of people who come back to India or Pakistan, most of them have lost their minds. So this is not let's say, the norm. This is actually the exception. And I have got comments from people saying, you've actually shown the prison pretty good. But it was the father and the boy's account, and the boy actually did develop a very close relationship with the female inspector. The father was not tortured afterwards. But, you know, the main suffering was to be isolated and kept away from their own homeland and from the wife and mother. But as I said, prisons in Pakistan and in India can be pretty rotten places.
Yeah. And then you brought in the religious factor, you know, they were Hindu and the captors were Muslim. And that was another, area of discord. Could you talk about presently, like how current is this film? I mean, are there still borders, and do people still cross and get picked up and put in prison? And
they do. I think at any given stage, I read about, I think about 2 months ago, there were about 600 to 700 prisoners either country, in both countries. And till I think about 3 months ago, two boys from the Pakistan side actually dug tunnel through and cross the fence, because now they have fencing in some parts of the border. In many parts, it's still porous like it's shown in the film, separated just by stones and pillars. But now they are fencing it. And accidental border crossings do happen because, there are so many villages which are very close to the border. Like this particular village was about 2 kilometers, so a lot of times the animals stray across. Fishermen, of course, stray into each other's waters all the time. And the good thing is, though, that recently both countries have commissioned retired judges to investigate cases of these prisoners who have been lost in the system of both countries, and hopefully they will dig them out. This film took place in 2002 when the relationship between India and Pakistan was at the lowest because both countries were on the brink of war. So as it is, communication was cut off. I think they are more careful these days, but still, you know, there's so much red tapism in our countries that it takes a while for cases to come to light.
Okay. We have like 37 seconds, so let's have a commercial really quickly. The Third Eye Film Festival begins on the 13th, which is tomorrow, in San Francisco at Brava Theater. And the website is thirdeye.org. And the phone number is 415-835-4783. And the film festival continues through what date?
November 16th.
Sunday the 16th. So anyway, it's going to be really great. How many films do you all have this year?
About 15.
Yeah, 15, including the short.
Okay, cool. All righty. So now you can continue with Rain.
The one thing I did want to say was,
yes,
Maureen's film is kind of epitomizes what we're trying to do and trying to think of the region as a South Asian region as opposed to India or Pakistan, because the film really boasts technicians and experts from across the border. Maureen, maybe you want to talk about that, just how you brought people from India and Pakistan together to make this film.
Sure. I mean, for example, the music has been done by a very renowned Indian music composer. We have a very powerful Indian voice of Shubha Mudgal, who's singing a couple of the songs. The recording of the music was done in India. My co-editor is an Indian. Of course, Nandita Das is an Indian. We had four American technicians working on the film. The post-production was done in America. So it's a film made by actually three countries.
That's great. Is that unusual? They have a collaboration like that?
It is, because, you know, it's very recent that India, Pakistan have gone, they've opened up their visas, etc. So, you know, artists as well can travel frequently to each other's countries. So it is becoming easier now, and there's so much we can take from the Indian film industry. It's the biggest in the world. And there's so much that Pakistan itself has to offer in terms of acting and you know, writers, etc. So I hope this goes on. It's a very positive sign.
Right, yeah. Well, any closing thoughts from anyone?
Come
and see the festival.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Yeah. Thank you for having us on your show, and I'm looking forward to meeting Maureen and seeing her film and in the festival. It should be wonderful.
Yes,
Yeah, the festival just seems really, really wonderful, and I certainly encourage everyone to check out, you know, all if not, you know, part if not all of this wonderful showcase of films from the Asian diaspora, again at Brava Theater in San Francisco, and the other venue is the Castro Theater, also in San Francisco. And the website is thirdeye.org, and the phone number is 415-835-4783. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Wanda.
All right, you take good care. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
See, also this weekend is the Green Festival. 125 speakers, Dr. Cornel West, Van Jones, Ricky Byers Beckwith, Aya De Leon, Christopher Muhammad, Ali Starr, Amy Goodman, Winona LaDuke, Gary Paul Nabhan, Medea Benjamin. And on the spoken word tip, there's going to be Chuck D, Muta Baruka, Reverend Lennox, Yearwood. It's going to be really, really, really a good event, and you can find out all about it at www.greenfestivals.org, greenfestivals.org. And that's also in San Francisco, November 14th, 15th, 16th at the Concourse Exhibition Center. This weekend is also the Race Conference, and that's in Oakland, and that begins on Friday also. So there's just so much to do. Visit us on the web at wandaspicks.com and listen in on Friday, November 14th, 8 to 10 a.m. for another edition of Wanda's Picks. And we want to thank all of our guests today, Robert King, Panther Herb, the directors of the Third Eye Film Festival, and Maureen Jabbar, who is a director who is having her film premiering on Saturday during the Third Eye Film Festival. Until then, go well. And I'm going to close out with the Equinox theme song, which I haven't had an opportunity to play yet. And we want to send our condolences to Mama Miriam Makeba's family. She just passed this past week. I think she's known as Mama Africa, a wonderful, wonderful woman who used art for the liberation of her country and her people in South Africa. Equinox theme song.
blind in the darkness. Change colors so me don't become a target. Them get those streets where we eat me the darker. Try bring the light when them come for me. Fire!